There's perhaps no parable of Jesus better known than the prodigal son. Everybody has heard this story, even people who are very tangential to Christianity, even in other countries, other cultures. The power of this story is so extremely universal. It transcends dogmas and churches and religions because it really resonates with the experience that every living human has, which is we have this reality of having belonged to someone or belonged to something. Maybe we associate it with our childhood or our parents. You know, we don't necessarily have conscious memories of existences, whether specific incarnations or even just existence, prior to the time we find ourselves in this body and looking at the world through these eyes and through this brain. But even if the conscious mind doesn't remember, something in us has the sense that we belong somewhere. If our upbringing was poignant, filled with disappointments or even outright tragedies, that sense of where do I belong becomes intensified. But if there wasn't the actual memory that there is someone who loves me and I do have a home, then we wouldn't be nearly so distressed by the lack of it. You see, that's the irony of it, isn't it? If we only believed that life was absolute misery and we really are alone and forgotten and forsaken by all, then that would just be our condition. There would be no point of reference. But even if the life itself has had nothing in it, there's a deeply held inner point of reference that someone loves me and I belong somewhere and someone will take care of me. So this story, the way Jesus tells it and the passages that come before, Swamiji picks the story up in the middle just for the sake of brevity. But the first part is the man had two sons. And the younger said to his father, give me my inheritance now, rather than having me wait until you die or you're ready. Give it to me now. And the father, perhaps unwisely, but allowing his son to learn, said, all right, here it is. So the younger son went off. He left his home. And he took that money and, thinking like people do, have very little sense of time, or very little sense of the fact that tomorrow will be now when tomorrow arrives. And this thought that I can just live for the moment and then everything will take care of itself. He went off and he squandered it on loose living. That's how the Bible puts it. So you can see him somewhere in some foreign country where no one knew him, where he had no family, and he shows up with all this wealth. He was probably handsome and very dashing. It's not spoken, but it's implied. And he spent his money and did all these wonderful things and thought he was being such a smart man instead of like his elder brother who was probably still slaving away at the farm waiting for the old man to die. He had everything that he should have. But then, the way the Bible tells it, famine struck the land. And he had run through his fortune. And now not only did he have no money, but now the whole country had gone into darkness. Oh, isn't that the way of things? It all looks like it's just going to work out fine, and then famine strikes the land in one form or another. In the Indian epics, the way it always happens is inadvertently the hero manages to get on the wrong side of an ascetic with a mighty temper. And then in one second, the ascetic becomes angry and he turns his fiery eyes on the poor wrongdoer and curses him. And then from that point, everything falls to pieces. The curse of the Rishi, it's called. I love that because so often in our lives, isn't that what happens? Everything is fine, and then somehow we suddenly come under the curse of the Rishi. We might not remember exactly when it happened, but famine strikes the land. And where there was abundance, and it was all easy, and everything was going our way, and we really had it together, and what do the scriptures know anyway, and there we are. And it is too possible to only live for yourself and be happy. Just look at me. Then famine strikes the land. And he had no more resources. He'd used them all up. And so he found himself begging for a job feeding the pigs. This is a very graphic story. The swine, actually, how they call it. So he's feeding the swine. And the swine are getting this really, what looks to him like really good food, and he wants to eat the food of the swine. Imagine how low we fall. But nobody offered it to him. And so there he is feeding the swine, and then he remembers that he belongs to someone, and that he thinks, in my father's house, the hired hands, you know, get better than I get here. He said, I'm going to go home. Now, you see, this is the story that we all face. He had to be brought so low, because in his pride and in his arrogance, he had it all figured out, but he had to be brought so low that he was lower than the swine before he said, I'm going to go home. And he said, I am no longer worthy to be my father's son. All that I was given, I squandered, but maybe my father will hire me to be a hired hand and I would still be better off. So he comes back with this thought that, what am I to expect? And as he gets close, to his astonishment, and this is where the reading is picked up here, the father, it's so sweet, the father sees him from a distance. It's not even as if he waits until the man gets all the way close. Now you see how different this is than, as Swami refers to, the average vindictive person who makes so much of all the slights that are given to him in life. Isn't that what we're like? Oh, so-and-so didn't speak to me today. Oh, I was passed over for that promotion. Why didn't my wife remember that this was what I really wanted? Why does she always feed me this kind of food when she knows I don't like it? Like that, isn't it? Or perhaps the wife feels that way about the husband sometimes. You never know. But all the different ways, and then we nurse them. We talk about them. We try to get over them. We think that we're still stuck with them. We process them. We have all these pictures in our minds about how everybody owes us. So naturally, this man thinks, I've completely dishonored my father in every possible way. And far from making good with what he gave me, I'm coming back with nothing. But the father sees him from a distance and doesn't wait for the man to grovel. Well, I'm going to wait till he comes and apologizes to me. You know, I'm not going to make the first move like this. I was reading in a magazine article about a husband and wife who were having an argument and they weren't speaking to each other. And then the man realized that he depended on his wife to wake him up early the next morning for a plane flight. He had to get up at 5 a.m., but he didn't want to break the silence, so he wrote her a note. Please wake me at 5 a.m. And so the next morning at 9, when he woke up, he found a note on his bed. Wake up, dear, it's 5 a.m. Contrary to that, the father saw him coming and ran out to meet him. There's so many parts of this story that are so poignant, aren't they? But that part of it, in some ways, just touches me the most. If one puts oneself into the mindset of the man, how will I be greeted? Will he even recognize me? Will he throw me off the property? But instead of that, he sees him from a distance and runs out to greet him, because this is the place where I really belong. Throws his arms about his neck and kisses him. It's so graphic, like that. And then the man says, Father, I've sinned against heaven and earth. You know, it's just like, how big can you make it? I've sinned against heaven and earth. And the father says, bring him a ring, bring him a robe, bring him shoes. And then that wonderful phrase, kill the fatted calf. Everybody jokes about that when there's the vegetarians, kill the fat zucchini, bring it forward, you know, because we have to make that story for ourselves. But of course, the whole story is not just about one nice dad somewhere. The whole story, it's a parable. It's the story of us, who somewhere along the line, and nobody actually can really pin the exact point, but we don't remember everything that we did in the past. Somehow or another, we took the inheritance of our father, and the inheritance of our father is being created itself. You know, we're just born. We're born as little babies, and we start out on that little, you know, that little journey, and we just make certain assumptions. We make all these assumptions. My energy is for me. What else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? That's what the little bird says in the Festival of Light. What else is wisdom? To keep what is mine for myself. And myself doesn't just mean that I'm not going to share with you, but it's that my life is about my ego. My life is not about who made me in the first place. You know, the mission that I was given. Like, why were we born? Isn't that an obvious question? I was so astonished growing up that people wanted to talk to me about everything, but nobody wanted to talk to me about why I was born. It seemed so fundamental to me. And of course, it was because they didn't know. I remember talking to my grandfather, who was an observant Jew. And I was very small because I didn't see him that much in my life. But I sort of said, you know, basically, do you really believe this stuff? This stuff meaning that there's more to this life than there seems? And he answered me like the good Jewish businessman he was. He said, well, if there isn't, I'll never know. And if there is, I've hedged my bet, basically. You know, I've observed, and therefore, if it turns out that there's a reason to have done it, I'll have done it. All right, but golly, that's not what I was going to ask. I asked my poor father once, we were Jews, of course, and the salient characteristic of Jews is that we don't believe in Jesus. That's what makes you a Jew, is that you don't believe in Jesus. I'm being extremely rude, so forgive me. There's more to it than that. But I was 10. I remember being 10. My father was shaving. That's when I used to talk to him. Daddy, why wasn't Jesus the Messiah? I said. My poor father, I mean, it was dangerous to ask him when he had the razor in his hand. I mean, just, you know. And he hemmed and hawed and tried to think of a good answer. And I could tell that he didn't have any idea. He had no idea why Jesus wasn't really the Messiah. He just knew that we believe that he's not. So I was courteous enough to let him off the hook and I changed the subject. But we come out with this divine potential. You see, our inheritance is that sense that we belong somewhere and bliss is my birthright. But we go out and we spend that inheritance. I'm going to get bliss this way. I'm going to belong to this person. I'm going to be part of this clan. I'm going to get this job. I'm going to have this house. I'm going to belong to this farm. These are my kids. You know, whatever it is. And we just dissipate that inheritance of bliss, spending it on all these other things. And maybe we're lucky, maybe we have good karma, maybe things work out all right, but maybe famine strikes the land. You know, right now, Swami Kriyananda is very disconcerting to very many people because every time he talks, he says, famine is going to strike the land, in essence. He's saying, Master said, depression is coming, hard times are coming, get ready for that. People are not happy to hear that because we're spending our inheritance on loose living and we don't want to hear that famine is about to strike. But that sense remains within us and we spend our bliss inheritance trying to just do all these other things. But sooner or later, whether it happens dramatically or not, you see, it's not like you have to wait until there's great tragedy. When I was first at Ananda Village, I was, you know, 24, 25, and I remember having a conversation with Swami Kriyananda. And I said to him, you know, I've been extremely blessed since the day I was born. I had a very loving family. I said, I've really almost never suffered, really suffered. And I said, and yet I was born with this intense desire, you know, to find an everlasting path to happiness. And it was just the only thing I wanted was an everlasting path to happiness. And I had this intense aversion to sort of any ordinary way of thinking. It all looked just like a dead end to me. And Swami, and I said, but I've never suffered. And Swami said the most obvious, well, in previous lives, my dear, that's where it's come. You know, we may not consciously remember, but the soul remembers. So it isn't a matter of, oh, I've never been miserable, I'll wait till I'm miserable. In fact, in Autobiography of a Yogi, I love the way Master puts it. He says, we just reincarnate and reincarnate again and again. And even tragedy has a certain dynamic interest to it. He said what really gets us after a while is what he called the anguishing monotony of it. Isn't that a brilliant phrase? Isn't that, and that is what really gets us, isn't it? That was my state of mind before I met Swami Kriyananda. I just called it, I was desperation. That's what Thoreau called it, I think. Most men live lives of quiet desperation. That's what he said. Because of the sheer anguishing monotony. Isn't there more to life than this? You see, that's the famine that actually sets in. It's a famine of meaning. It's a famine of not belonging. It's a famine of not having everlasting love. It's the famine of not having eternal bliss. And we try to pretend that we're happy without it, but we're not. It's just as simple as that, because our souls were made for thee alone. Our hearts were made for thee alone. And we will not be content until we find our rest in thee. But then, of course, what happens to us, and this is where it has to also be understood that it's a parable. We don't go and find some God somewhere. There really is not that kind of judgment day, you know, that's depicted on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel and in so many stories where there's thunder and lightning, and then those who are saved march up and they get to go to the heavenly side and the others go to the hell side, and there's some other egoic being that's standing there saying yes or no, like the Roman emperors, you know, live or die. It's nothing like that. In fact, it's so profoundly different that that's part of the confusion, because what we come home to is our own inner state of rest. And what we discover is that inner state of rest was always there. It was just behind all that noise and anxiety. It's so peculiar. That's why we call it realization. Realization is such an interesting and profound word. It's not like we go out and find it. We talk about finding God, but we find him right where we left him, which was always within our own selves. All that we ever experience is our own consciousness. And everything else is transitory. All we ever have is our own consciousness. We are either conscious of the infinite, or we have directed our attention to something else. And this is where, in this story, that the second scriptural passage, not from the Bible, but from the Bhagavad Gita, is just about pulling our consciousness back from all that loose living, even if we're not living dissipated lives by the standards of society. We've let our minds get loose, and our minds are loose, and they're running around grabbing at things, grabbing at this desire, grabbing at that desire, holding on to this anxiety, nursing this particular sense of, you know, abuse that happened to us, or this trauma that happened to us. You know, it's so peculiar. I myself have always, I love to think about death. I don't find it even slightly morbid. I find it extremely exhilarating to realize that sooner or later, everything that we cling to, that we think of as ourselves, just fades away. When my mother died, as it happened, I left on a Sunday and she died on an early Tuesday morning, and I had flown to Europe. She was very unwell. She had Parkinson's, and the Parkinson's had, after 15 years, had begun to give her seizures. And it was not pretty, and she was not doing so great. And she died quite unexpectedly. I was actually in Rome, and my sister calls on the phone and said, "Mom died." And you know what I said? "Good for her." Just like that, good for her. She just let go. She was willing to just let go and get out of that body. So then I was faced with this interesting dilemma. I was visiting Swamiji at the time. I didn't come back. I stayed where I was. And I'd been very dutiful to her and took good care of her toward the end and so on. But now that she was gone, I sort of didn't want to have to continue to feel responsible for her. And I found it hard to let go of the sense of responsibility. So I asked Swamiji, you know, my question was really this: if I stop thinking about her, will she know? You know, like, will I hurt her feelings if I don't just keep worrying about her all the time? Is she okay in the astral world and so on? And I said, will she remember? And his comment was, she probably has a sort of vague sense that something happened, but the details have already begun to fade out for her. It's a very interesting answer. You know, that because of her level of consciousness, she wasn't exalted enough to be able to see this world. Now, bear in mind, for those of you who don't want to feel bad about this, that your loved ones have just turned their back on you cheerfully and gone on. Whatever's real about the connection. And just because you were in the same family doesn't mean that you were also deeply soul connected. But whatever's real about the connection endures through all eternity. That's why when you meet someone again in this life, they seem familiar to you. You just pick up where you left off. And that's for the most part why you're drawn to have the children you have, the friends you have, the spouses you have, all those things, is because these threads of light through many lifetimes are vibrating there. But we have so many more associations than we know about. Just think about all the incarnations you have. So it's not as if they're erased. They're just put in abeyance until it's time again for them to be resurrected. Just like many things, like a child has many things that are the potential for their future. I mean, if when you're a child and you haven't yet met your spouse or are not in the company of the people who are going to be your children, it doesn't mean that those associations are any less real. It's just that they haven't come to fruition yet. It's not their moment. So when Swamiji was talking about my mother being in the astral world, and I just wanted to know if I could be mentally free of concern for her, and he assured me that I could and her feelings wouldn't be hurt. Also, to the extent that she was conscious, it would be okay. But I thought again, like, how... Well, to stay with my mother one more minute, when I asked her if she was afraid of dying, her answer was just classic. She said, "No, but I hate to think of all this going on and my not being here anymore." You know, just like wanting to just kind of stay in the game and thinking that she was going to just, like, I don't know, be bored afterwards, but not just wanting to stay in the game. But the fact of the matter is, you see, as soon as our consciousness withdraws from this body, we still have our ego in the astral body, but all of the manifested waves of this world, they just cease to exist for us. And so no matter how intensely we've been trying to get our bliss from all these manifested waves, in the end we just go, we sink back into the foundation reality of all of it. And that's where our father is. Our father in the sense of our guru and the father, divine mother, the infinite spirit. But also what we're sinking deeply back into is the deeper reality of our own nature. And that's why we can't escape it. And that's why no matter how hard we try, sooner or later we will come back to it. That's why success on the spiritual path is guaranteed. That's why you can't sin enough to ever actually break the tie. Because what we're actually doing when we behave wrongly, whether it's to be a mass murderer or just to be a lazy bum, whatever it might be, we have actually gone to where we don't belong. You see, that's why the parable is, he goes to a foreign land. That little word, he goes to a foreign land, but then sooner or later he comes back. And as soon as he comes back, his own self, which is his father, runs to meet him and embraces him. Now this story, as I said at the beginning, is known everywhere. Because all of us need to keep this absolutely foremost in our minds. The only thing that keeps us from our divine relationship is our lack of willingness to receive it. That's why in the Bible it says, John says about Jesus, "As many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God." In other words, as many as were willing to turn toward that light, the light completely infused them. And the only thing that keeps us from that is our determination to live in a foreign land. And then sometimes our growing fear of what might happen if I turn back. What might happen if you turn back? Your father will spy you from a distance, run out, wrap his arms around you, and he will kill the fatted calf and feed it to you. You know, what could be more glorious And why waste any more time?